Welcome to the Nordic Africa Institute podcast. I am Heba Habib, Communications Officer at the Institute. The Nordic Africa Institute is a six-year-old organization devoted to deepening understanding of contemporary Africa. This podcast, which we have semi-jokingly subtitled, Don't Quote Me on That, is a series of conversations with our researchers analyzing the issues of the day. On the 25th of February, Nigerians will head to the polls to choose a successor to incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari. These elections are arguably the most important on the continent this year. Even though Africa's biggest economy and oil producer has gone through tumultuous times due to complex security crises and a struggling economy, it's still a major influence on the continent. Who is likely to win these elections, and what will it mean for Nigeria's future and for its young voters, 40% of whom are under 35 and ready for change? Here to explore these questions with me are Nye Associates, Professor Kwesi Aning, Director of Faculty of Academic Affairs and Research at the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center, and Professor Victor Adetola, former head of research at the Nordic Africa Institute and a current professor of international relations and development studies at the University of Jos in Nigeria. Professor Kwesi is joining us from Oslo, where he is today. Welcome, gentlemen. So my first question to you, professors, is Nigeria's central bank recently redesigned the Naira, and partly to limit bribing voters. So how do you think that might affect the vote?
How is it going to affect it? I will not say in a very fundamentally significant way. Rather, it will help people to be more careful and to prevent the misuse of money. That is it. But I don't think the Naira was changed exclusively because of election. No. I think it's more fundamental than that.
And what do you think, Professor Kwesi?
No, I think the rule of money, particularly unaccounted for and unaccountable inflows of money into elections, has been a problem with the democracies in West African states for quite a long time. But this decision coming from the central bank is even more important, taking into consideration the fact that Nigeria is one of the few countries in Africa that prints its own money. You know, what that means in practice is that by changing the face of the notes so close to the elections and hopefully mopping up the loose currency in the system that do not pass through the banking sector, this will reduce the availability of financial flows to those who seek to gain power. And hopefully, the reduction of the impact of money in swaying and distorting the voting patterns might help us get a candidate and a president who really represents the interests of the people. So I think in terms of the practical, operational, most intended and unintended impacts of the change, it may have a long-term net positive impact on democracy and the elections in particular.
Fantastic. The Labour Party candidate, who may be surprising everyone and winning the vote. Other pundits say this is unlikely, but he does seem popular, especially amongst the youth, with one poll from Bloomberg claiming that he could receive 72% of the vote. How likely is it that he would win, and what would that mean for Nigeria? And I sense Professor Victor is skeptical already.
I'm not skeptical as I am with what is on ground. I think it's too early to make categorical statement about who is going to win the election. But having said that, Nigeria is a very complex society, one. And the issue of polling, public opinion survey, is still relatively undeveloped, which suggests that there is, you know, need to be careful when we want to make judgment or analysis based on a survey, you know, because there are so many things that are not yet there. But what is the trend in the country today? You're right to say that there are a lot of young people about Peter Obi. No doubt about that. There is a lot of hunger and anger. Whether that has developed into constructive movement, you see, that can be the basis of far-reaching change in the process and outcome of election is another thing.
Interesting.
But significantly different from what it used to be, that we say, oh, this election is going to be between two that are in between the two key political parties. And it's not only Peter Obi. You have Kwankwaso. Mm-hmm. And the Kwankwasaya movement, with its roots in northern Nigeria, started far before Obi. That is it. Yeah, so the trend to note is that, far different from what we used to have, that there's two-horse competition. The next election, we're likely to have 3, 4, 5, you know, possibilities to choose from. So that's what I can say. And to me, it goes to explain that, look, increasingly, or let's say progressively, the people are having more than two options to choose from, which is good for democracy. But whether it will result in radical change, that the votes of the young people on the streets is a different thing. I have not seen an example of that in Africa.
Of having multiple
Where this kind of youth movement have translated into change through election. I've not seen an example of that.
Discussing the Arab Spring earlier, so
not
yes.
Even from the Arab Spring,
no.
Not even with Tunisia, not even in South Africa. That's the only thing I can say.
So it is an interesting development for the whole continent in a way that mm-hmm. this happened.
Mm-hmm.
It could have a trickle down effect, you think?
We are expressing digital revolution across the continent at different levels. And everybody has a cell phone. Everybody has a Twitter account, especially the young people here and there. But again, I get worried that somebody and the fields. Because I also see, just like we just talked about the possibility of misuse of money, mm-hmm. I've also seen tendency towards the misuse of these modern ICT platforms. I've seen hate speech, I've seen rumor, I've seen lies. So these are my concerns. That possibly, if in addition to the digital revolution, we also have commensurate civic revolution, then maybe we can now say, okay, we are going to be very, very hopeful.
Well, let's see. And let's see what Professor Kwesi thinks. What do you think, Professor Kwesi?
Peter Obi's entry, participation in the race for the presidency certainly is very fascinating. But I think Peter Obi also brings something quite new. And here I want to locate my contribution within the context of the end SARS movement in Nigeria in 2020 that resulted in the death of several young people and the role of the military and the more established political elite in behaving in a way that created a clear schism as to the driving demand for change and people's expectation that change will come. So Peter's ability to speak in a manner that resonates with the youth, those who feel dispossessed, those who feel victims of this 2-3 party horse race, those who feel that they are not reaping the fruits of the democratic process, are all sort of heading towards, Peter. And he has got a message that seems to speak to what their aspirations and expectations are. But as to whether that will translate into an actual thumbprint or an electronic vote for Peter, I think the jury is still out there. But Victor made two critical points that I want to come to. One is the undeveloped nature of our pooling. So people say one thing, increase expectations of a particular outcome, and then it doesn't happen. But I mean, it's not only on the African continent or in Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, Tunisia, and Egypt that it doesn't happen. I think even in the developed West that we've seen a few examples where it's turned out to be something else. But it is the impact of digital technology, its widespread use and accessibility, and the ways that it is being used that bothers me. One is that we should not overlook the attempt by outside forces to manipulate the system. I mean, we saw it in the Ghana elections in 2020. We've seen it elsewhere. But the way in which political parties on the continent are using the digital space not to send out their messages, but rather to intimidate and to use deep fake information to sway the thinking, the analysis, and people's perceptions of what the most critical issues are. So Peter's entrance onto the scene opens new vestiges for engagement, for discourses, but it creates a certain optimism. And as Victor is saying, I think a direct correlation between Peter's role and these new ideas coming onto the table, translating into actual votes. And I think the Bloomberg assessment of 72% is way too optimistic. I think we need to be a bit more cautious because the old guys are not going to go down without a credible fight.
Yes.
Definitely. But in all cases, it seems, and as you say, there is now multiple options, so to speak, in Nigeria. And it looks like it's going to be a close election. How will that impact Nigeria, especially in the last, you know, in the light of the last few years marked by economic troubles?
Well, I'm not too sure whether security, and I think they hear Victor can help us. I'm not sure how much security has been put on the agenda during the campaign. That's number one. Number two, we have an armed forces of Nigeria that is a powerful force in its own right. You know, so for any qualitative shift and change in the strategy towards the northeast, the southeast, in terms of responding to the insecurities that we find, we need a political party and a president who has a very clear understanding of the complexity of the problems that are there, the role of multiple stakeholders, not only the military, but bringing in probably also traditional leaders, youth, women's groups, and religious bodies, in transforming the discourse around insecurity. Because the insecurities are closely related also to the fear of investing economically in long-term sustainable livelihoods. I mean, this is a really very crucial and important question. But it's a question I would argue that would need a president who has thought through this very carefully. Because when Mr. Buhari came to power, there was a lot of optimism that being a former military general, that he would have a much more nuanced and sophisticated understanding and approach to dealing with the security problems. That has not panned out the way we expected. So there's a lot of work, and the new president certainly has his work cut out for him, both on the security and on the economic front.
So, go ahead.
You now see the reason why I defer to on that. And it's a good thing that he made reference to 2015. In 2015, security was an issue. And the two dominant parties, within the limited understanding that they had, were able to say a few things about it and campaign around the issue. Now, where we are is such that none of the candidates, none of the party has the confidence or even the knowledge to engage the issue around security the way Nigeria would have been feel satisfied and make political judgment out of it. The information about it is not even out. Beyond some peripheral reference to, oh, we are going to do security. When journalists will ask how, they fizzle out. And it can be, it's understandable because it require very firm, decisive move that is knowledge driven. Unfortunately, such is not yet available as we have seen. And on the issue of economy, will anything happen that is a fundamental change? I can say that the expectations are high. the prayers very deep that, look, the new government that is coming in should take us out of where we are. Like I said in the beginning of this conversation, that there is a lot of anger that is coming from hungry mouths. But whether the political parties, the candidates have been able to respond appropriately, again, based on deeper, clear understanding of what needs to be done to revamp the economy, is a very, very difficult situation, the way we are.
I see. There are some fears that this could turn into a rigged election, despite recent reforms in Nigeria. Do you think that's likely, or is this empty punditry, kind of?
Well, this on the reform, the electoral reform, I will say, because I can comment on that, that there have been a lot of significant move. The legal framework for the administration and management of election has received a lot of boost. That I can tell you. But, and of course that has been tested with some of the off-season election, and it turned out to be remarkable success. But human ingenuity is something else. While some of us were celebrating the electoral reform, and the outcome from the off-season election, people came up with another tactics of buying votes. Where we were celebrating and saying, now the voters are aware that their votes count. And we thought, that's high level of voters' education. Voters are now very important, more than violence. We discovered that the politicians are now ready to buy the voters. And that the voters are ready to sell their vote to the highest bidder. So some of these things give us concern that, look, and we're beginning to say, hey, good law, good legal framework, fantastic, but good voters' behavior also matters much, that there is need to get the voters to the point where, money in this man does not really count. That is the point at which we are now, to convince the voters that, look, rather than take, comfort in immediate gain in terms of monetary inducement, think about long-term investments that will come, through voting the right people in. So that is the point we are making, that, look, yes, reform, yeah, but the people need to be welcome, because the reform has not automatically changed the main actors, the politicians. And they really need to change for things to work well. That's my view.
Any thoughts, Professor Kwesi?
Well, I think once more, I want to tag on to what Peter has just said. One is the rhetoric of reform and inclusiveness, and the reality of actually doing politics in a manner where there's a correlation between the promises made and implementation when politicians win power. And more often than not, the real challenge is not with the ordinary electorate, who would routinely see these four-year cycles and the intensive last 6 months of campaigning as normal. opportunity, probably to gain something small from the politicians. I think what we need when we talk reform, electoral reform, but issues of participation, deliverability and implementation, is to get the political parties and their politicians to understand the importance of the linkages between the promises they make and their ability to deliver as a means of bringing some credibility to the system as a whole. You know, so far, there is this lacuna where politicians just talk, and that is just it. You know, we don't hold them accountable, and they talk reform. More often than not, very much aware that they wouldn't deliver on those reforms. And there's very little accountability. There's very little that the electorate itself can do to hold them accountable. So to be able to bring about the change that people expect, you know, in which public service is about what it is, service and delivering of social welfare goods, then I think the disconnect between these expectations and people's active participation will continue to be ever present in our politics.
So, in your opinion, both of you, of course, what will be the most important deciding factor in this particular election? Or is that too grandiose a thing to demand?
No, I think most people are looking for any party that will create an enabling environment for people, families, communities to go about their daily lives. I mean, my argument has always been that most people just want, you know, a stable environment that allows them to go to farm, market, to teach, go to the hospital, wherever they work, and to come back and to have a pipeline to see their children go to school and grow and, you know, also move on. I think any party that can make a convincing argument that, look, we understand where you are, and we share your certainties and your sense of fear. We share your worries about the high cost of daily living. And these are the specific things that we intend to do, not to wipe away all these problems, but at least to respond to them in a manner that is qualitatively different to improve your lives. Then I think people are going to listen. And it is those kinds of messages that are simple to understand, that speaks to people's daily lives and seems to respond to their challenges, that will form the deciding factors that will sway people's votes.
And are there any other parties more of than the other giving these kinds of guarantees or promises in any convincing manner? Oh, go ahead, Professor.
For me, we are not yet there, not yet to who. Democracy in progress. Electoral democracy in progress. It is not likely that we will get there with this bank. So, but we are likely to move some steps forward, you know, towards the promised land. But to solve this problem, like you even put it into, to solve insecurity, to solve economic thing, no, we are not yet there. And I think Kwesi has been able to even elaborate that, look, what are the hearing of the people? What do they want? They want security. They want to be able to conduct their business, their relationship in a way that they don't have to be watching their back all the time? Do we even have promises that has correctly targeted those things? Maybe some rhetorics around them, but we are not yet there. But like I said, the expansion of the democratic space, the confidence, the courage with which some people are coming out to say, look, we don't have to belong to either of the dominant political parties. The courage of some people to say, hey, yes, we want to do it. We want the voice of the youth to be heard. We want women to be part of the process. I think these are things that we have to note as progress in the journey towards the promised land.
Well, let us hope Nigeria reaches the promised land very soon. And I would like to thank you both for taking the time to chat with me about this very interesting subject. Of course, we could be here for another hour easily, but I will spare you for now. Thank you, Professor Kwesi, and thank you, Professor Victor. And on to the next podcast, I hope. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.